two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth, then took the other as just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim because it was grassy and wanted wear. Though as for that, the passing there had worn them really about the same, and both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day, yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference.
You're listening to Sonic Lit, a spoken web radio show. We are listening to classic poems this afternoon. I'm Catherine McLeod here in the studio with Jason Camelot. Hi, Jason. How's it going?
It's going really well. And it made all the difference to take the road less traveled. We're listening to poems that we probably have heard hundreds of times in our lives, being literature teachers, you know, and having studied literature since elementary school and high school. And these are some of the poems that are probably taught the most of any of the poems in history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in our listening on this show, we've been really doing some deep dives into sound poetry and listening to some of the most avant-garde forms of poetry that we can play for you on Sonic Lit. And today, you know, Jason said to me, I have an idea. And I thought, well, what could this idea be? Is it yet another avant-garde sound poet? And no, in fact, he suggested, well, we've been listening to such experimental poetry. Often, you know, when listening to it, sometimes we might even be thinking, you know, is this poetry or is this music? Is this noise? Is this art? Is this something else, some sort of just environmental sound even, or atmospheric sound? And so we thought we would, it's almost like returning back to the page and thinking like, okay, what has a poem been thought of in a sort of a more traditional way, returning back to, say, like the classics, the you know, the songbook of poetry, and listen to some of these classic poems. And I think it'll be really interesting to hear them after having heard such experimental poetry that we've been listening to in the past weeks. I feel like I'm going to hear them anew this afternoon.
Yeah, The Road Not Taken that we just heard by Robert Frost. Mm-hmm. I suppose in its time actually was considered unique and different because Robert Frost, and I wouldn't even say it's a page poem in many ways. It was a poem that he made a career of reciting, among some other ones. We'll listen to Stopping by Woods in a Snowy Evening and a few others by Robert Frost. But Frost is one of those poets who seems very accessible and yet profound, but accessible because he – and this is the way he phrased it. He spoke poems, right? Mm-hmm. So basically, he was a poet who delivered his poetry in a vernacular manner, right? In a way that suggested a kind of folksy or rootsy, equivalency between poetry and speech. Mm-hmm. And we heard a little bit of that. I mean, it's a rhyming poem, so in some ways, it might sound, you know, like poetry or poet. To us, but in other ways, when he was becoming an important poet in America, he was really seen as unique for the way he combined rhymed poetry. He wrote in blank verse, not in free verse. He was notorious for, you know, really identifying himself as a poet who didn't write much in free verse, but at the same time delivered his iambic blank poetry lines, often rhyming poems, in ways that suggested natural speech. Mm-hmm. And that's maybe one of the ingredients for a certain kind of classic. We're thinking of what makes a poem a classic in the traditional canonical way. Mm-hmm. And accessibility.
Especially a poem that's classic for being read out loud or like a poem to listen to. And I think we'll be thinking as we listen about how these poems are being read. Often they'll, I think in most cases, be read by the author. It'll be interesting to see if we have any in our mix that are not. But to really think of how these poems are being read and why they're so ear-catching, I guess, why they get into people's minds and become hits of poetry.
Yeah, these are like the earworms of poetry.
Yeah.
And I think we'll have probably something like 50-50 in terms of the poets who wrote them reading them versus poets who wrote them not reading them, but them being read by actors or elocutionists or people who are hired to read poetry on poetry records that would be often used in the classroom as well. You know?
Yeah. All right. So what are we going to hear next?
Well, what shall I compare thee to?
Possibly a summer's day or a November day.
Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May, and summer's lease hath all too short a date. Sometime too hot the eye of heaven shines, and often his gold complexion dimmed, and every fair from fair sometime declines by chance or nature's changing course untrimmed. But thy eternal summer shall not fade, nor lose possession of that fair thou owest, nor shall death brag thou wanderest in his shade, when in eternal lines to time thou growest. So long as men can breathe or eyes can see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee.
Hope is the thing with feathers. Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. And sweetest in the gale is heard, and sore must be the storm that could abash the little bird that kept so many warm. I've heard it in the chillest land and on the strangest sea, yet never in extremity it asked a crumb.
Hopping by woods on a snowy evening. Whose woods these are, I think I know.
His house
is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness belts a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sounds the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep.
And miles to go before I sleep. So it's also interesting to think of how many of these poems do we know, at least partially by heart, actually?
Yes, you might have heard Jason reciting the poem along with it. And if you are a longtime listener to Sonic Lit, a spoken web radio show, even though it has only been on the air for a year and a couple months, you will know that we had a whole episode devoted to poetry and memory and poems that people carry with them in their minds and in their hearts, and thinking about what poems we hold on to and remember. So probably a lot of these ones. and it made me think back to that episode as Jason was reciting the poem here. So we just heard three poems. We heard Shall I Compare Thee to a Summer's Day, the William Shakespeare sonnet as read by John Neville. We heard Hope is the... What was the end of the...
Hope is the thing.
Oh, the
eternal.
Hope is the thing. by Emily Dickinson. That was a test. We also... heard the Robert Frost poem that Jason was just reciting, which was
Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. Mm-hmm. The John Neville recording is kind of interesting to listen to because of the reverb that was used.
Yes.
I found it off-putting, personally.
Yeah, it seemed... just like it made me think about the way that I'll often teach that poem, emphasizing the way in which it is iambic pentameter, but also to think about that opening line of like, you can really hear the iambic pentameter with like, shall I compare thee to a summer's day? But you don't necessarily read it like that. You read it like, shall I compare thee to a summer's day? And there's an ebb and flow to it, but it's also a good line for students to remember. Oh yeah, iambic pentameter, it's that one. So then hearing him read it in such a slow, drawn out way, and yeah, kind of with this reverb, and it sounded very ominous. And I don't know, it seemed a little odd given the content of the poem. But
I mean, it was well read. It was definitely read in an understated way. But I was just—it's interesting to think about some of these recordings. This is a bit of a hodgepodge mix of classic poems that we're listening to, and they come from different recording sources. Some of them are studio recordings. Some of them are live readings. And that one, for some reason, the engineer decided to throw some reverb on it to give it a kind of echoey, space.
Yeah, and that was quite different from then the Emily Dickinson poem that came in right after it.
Yeah, which was very dry and present and matter of fact in its own way. And then the Frost recording, I'm not sure which Frost record, he made many recordings in his lifetime. And delivered thousands of readings as well, but he did do a mixture of records that were live readings, and then he did some studio recordings. He did some recordings on NBC Radio, actually, in different places. So speaking of the Poetry from Memory project, I have to say I didn't do an actual count, so I haven't collected the stats on it yet. But the poem that the most people know by heart for that project anyways. Basically what we do is we invite people to record a poem that they know by heart onto a reel-to-reel tape recorder. And the poem that always wins is In Flanders Fields.
Interesting.
And this recording is by someone or by a group that I'm not familiar with called Poella. So this, let's hear what this sounds like. But it's going to be the poem In Flanders Fields with musical accompaniment on piano.
In Flanders Fields the poppies blow between the crosses row on row that mark our place, and in the sky the larks still bravely singing fly, scarce heard amid the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago, we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow. Loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders Fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you from failing hands we throw. The torch be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders Fields. In the bleak midwinter, frosty wind made moan. Earth stood hard as iron, water like a stone. Snow had fallen, snow on snow, snow on snow, in the bleak midwinter, long ago. Our God, heaven cannot hold him, nor earth sustain. Heaven and earth shall flee away when he comes to reign. In the bleak midwinter, a stable place sufficed. The Lord God Almighty, Jesus Christ. Enough for him whom cherubim worship night and day, breast full of milk and a manger full of hay. Enough for him whom angels fall before, the ox and ass and camel which adore. Angels and archangels may have gathered there, cherubim and seraphim thronged the air. But his mother only, in her maiden bliss, worshipped the beloved with a kiss. What can I give him, poor as I am? If I were a shepherd, I would bring a lamb. If I were a wise man, I would do my part. Yet what I can, I give him, give my heart.
Remember by Christina Rossetti. Remember me when I am gone away, gone far away into the silent land, when you can no more hold me by the hand, nor I half turn to go, yet turning stay. Remember me when no more day by day you tell me of our future that you planned. Only remember me. You understand it will be late to counsel then or pray. Yet if you should forget me for a while, and afterwards remember, do not grieve. For if the darkness and corruption leave a vestige of the thoughts that once I had, better by far you should forget and smile than that you should remember and be.
I cut off remember. It was getting too sad for me, really. it was just too much. That's a lot of Christina Rossetti for... for one show.
Yeah, the poem that we heard before, Remember, was also by Christina Rossetti. It was the poem In the Bleak Midwinter, but you might have recognized it because it's been set to music many, many times as a Christmas carol on the Winter Solstice album number 2, and also by Sarah McLachlan, among many, many others. So if some of these, you know, poems sound familiar, sometimes they have been set to music, and they're, you know, it's interesting thinking which ones get chosen for that reason. But that was a lovely version by Poella of In the Bleak Midwinter. And before that, we heard In Flanders Fields, also set to piano.
Yeah. In the Bleak Midwinter, so that was a poem that was published under the title A Christmas Carol, not to be confused with Charles Dickens's novella A Christmas Carol, by Christina Rossetti in 1872. And it was first put to music in the early 20th century, around 1906. And then there have been multiple versions before Sarah McLachlan, even of it as an actual sung Christmas carol. Yeah.
Yes. You know, it's always interesting. I know, I certainly find for myself that the poems that are also, that have been set to music, I remember. I find it's easier to memorize those poems. So,
yeah, I have to say the reason that I know the words to Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening is because when I was a teenager, I put that to music
and turned it into
a song. Really how I have been able to remember the lyrics to that poem. I think of them as lyrics, actually. Yeah.
Well, the poem that I think we are going to hear next is by Dylan Thomas. And Dylan Thomas is a poet who recorded a number of his poems on vinyl in the 1950s. He was a poet who people wanted to record and then distribute and circulate those records. People wanted to buy his his albums of poetry. And I think you'll hear why when you hear the poem. He also, I think some of his poems are some of the most remembered poems. So you might very likely remember the poem will sound familiar to you. I think we're going to hear a couple of his poems throughout this show. But this one is the poem, Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night. And yeah, let's have a listen to it.
Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Though wise men at their end know dark is right, because their words had forked no lightning, they do not go gentle into that good night. Good men the last wave by, crying how bright their frail deeds might have danced in a green bay. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Wild men who caught and sang the sun in flight, and learned too late they grieved it on its way. Do not go gentle into that good night. Grave men near death, who see with blinding sight, blind eyes could blaze like meteors and be gay. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. And you, my father, there on the sad height, curse, bless me now with your fierce tears, I pray. Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage.
From November 20th rage to 30th, experience RIDM, the Montreal International Documentary Festival. Bold films that redefine documentary cinema and reframe how we see the world. Featuring screenings, concerts, discussions with filmmakers, and celebrations that carry the experience into the night. RIDM, November 20th to 30th in Montreal. Info and tickets at ridm.ca.
She Walks in Beauty by Lord Byron. She walks in beauty like the night of cloudless climes and starry skies, and all that's best of dark and bright meet in her aspect and her eyes, thus mellowed to that tender light which heaven to gaudy day denies. One shade the more, one ray the less, had half impaired the nameless grace which waves in every raven tress or softly lightens o'er her face, where thoughts serenely sweet express how pure, how dear their dwelling place. And on that cheek and o'er that brow so soft, so calm yet eloquent, the smiles that win, the tints that glow, but tell of days in goodness spent. A mind at peace with all below, a heart whose love is innocent.
Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. The carriage held but just ourselves and immortality. We slowly drove. He knew no haste, and I had put away my labor and my leisure too for his civility. We passed the school where children played at wrestling in a ring. We passed the fields of gazing grain. We passed the setting sun. We paused before a house that seemed a swelling of the ground. The roof was scarcely visible, the cornice but a mound. Since then, 'tis centuries, and yet feels shorter than the day I first surmised the horses' heads were toward eternity.
In my craft or sullen art, exercised in the still night, when only the moon rages, and the lovers lie abed with all their griefs in their arms. I labor by singing light, not for ambition or bread, or the strut and trade of charms on the ivory stages, but for the common wages of their most secret heart. Not for the proud man apart from the raging moon I write on these spindrift pages, nor for the towering dead with their nightingales and psalms, but for the lovers, their arms round the briefs of the ages, who pay no praise or wages, nor heed my craft or art.
You're listening to CJLO 1690. This is the Sonic Lit Show. I'm Jason Camlett. I'm here with Catherine McLeod, and we're listening to classics. Classic poems recited sometimes by the authors who wrote them and sometimes by actors. For instance, we had Julie Harris reading Because I Could Not Stop for Death. There's a lot of death poems here, Catherine, and it's just too much for me. That's why I had to cut off Do Not Go Gentle into That Good Night. It's just getting too sad.
Yeah, well, I was also very pulled into the reading In My Craft by Dylan Thomas. They're, you know, the line about like poets or something, lovers with arms around the grief of the world or something. It was very sad too. Well, maybe there's something about that makes these poems classics. They are really like hitting deep in our hearts.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a second. Yeah. What makes a classic? already established a degree of accessibility, yet at the same time, maybe inaccessibility, the sense that there's something profound about it.
Yeah.
And maybe that's also communicated through the use of particular rhythm and rhyme schemes. We talked about iambic pentameter. What is iambic pentameter, by the way?
Well, that's a way to count the rhythm of the poem. Iambic meaning that it's an iam, meaning
unstressed.
And then pentameter meaning that there's five of them. So the pent is the five, and then the meter meaning the measure of the pace of the poem. And so there's five iams in the line. And so also poems have lines. They don't have sentences.
Yeah, that's right. They're lineated. there are line breaks. Yeah, it seems like a lot of the poems that we've heard so far, these classics, use iambic pentameter. Mm-hmm. Shall I compare thee to a summer day, right? That's that's an iambic pentameter line,
yeah.
Right? Unstressed, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah. It also made me think of, well, just the in my craft, that is not iambic pentameter, but it felt like there was sort of a measured pacing to the poem. So whether, you know, sometimes the poem maybe has a certain lilt to it that connects to its content, but sometimes maybe the lines are actually measured. I was just thinking In My Craft or Sutherland Art. That's about, that's maybe 6-7 syllables and not iambic pentameter, but I think that each of the lines are around that length. And so there's something about when the poem kind of creates an anticipation where the listener can start to kind of anticipate what's coming rhythmically. And then it's like a song, where you can sort of tap along to it and you kind of get into the rhythm, even if you don't know exactly what's coming next. So it feels like, you know, whether it's iambic pentameter or something else, that these hits have a rhythm to it. The listener is not thrown off and the listener's not lost in it.
Yeah. But also that maybe the rhythm or the use of a particular rhythm and rhyme scheme is not the end in itself, but mm-hmm. there has to be a real coherence, a synthesis between the meaning, the words, the diction, the message of the poem, and the formal elements and the rhythmic elements of the poem that have been chosen. And maybe that's what distinguishes sometimes between what we're calling, or discussing as classic poems and, say, the poems we find on Hallmark cards, which often have, very discernible rhythms and rhyme schemes in them as well.
Right, but maybe they don't go far in terms of the depth of the content and the what's happening in inside the poem. We need both for it to be a hit.
Yeah. Just as a sidebar, I don't know about you, but my mom, whenever she gave me a birthday card or something, she would spend a lot of time trying to find just the right Hallmark card, you know, with the right poem in it for me. And she wouldn't write a message of her own. She would just, you know, choose the card and then just sign her name at the bottom, like as though she composed it. So for some people, the poems that appear even in Hallmark cards are really meaningful and important.
Right. Yeah, you could collect those or put them, publish a small chapbook of those found poems. But
if I had kept them, I could do that.
Well, moving right along here, I'm seeing what's coming next, but really the question is whether, we're going here next. I was getting a little ahead of myself.
There was a nightingale mentioned in my craft, and so it seems appropriate to play this one.
That's true. Ode to a Nightingale.
My heart aches, and a drowsy numbness pains my sense, as though of hemlock I had drunk, or emptied some dull opiate to the drains, 1 minute past, and lethe wards had sunk. 'Tis not through envy of thy happy lot, but being too happy in thine happiness, that thou, light-winged dryad of the trees, in some melodious plot of beech and green and shadows numberless, singest of summer in full-throated ease. Oh, for a draught of vintage that hath been cooled a long age in the deep-delved earth, tasting of flora and the country green, dance and Provençal song and sunburned mirth. Oh, for a beaker full of the warm south, full of the true, the blushful hippocrene, with beaded bubbles winking at the brim and purple-stained mouth, that I might drink and leave the world unseen, and with thee fade away into the forest dim. Fade far away, dissolve, and quite forget what thou among the leaves hast never known. The weariness, the fever, and the fret, here where men sit and hear each other groan, where palsy shakes a few sad last grey hairs, where youth grows pale and spectre thin and dies, where but to think is to be full of sorrow and leaden-eyed despairs, where beauty cannot keep her lustrous eyes, or new love pine at them beyond tomorrow. Away, away, for I will fly to thee, not charioted by Bacchus and his bards, but on the viewless wings of poesy, though the dull brain perplexes and retards. Already with thee, tender is the night, and haply the queen moon is on her throne, clustered around by all their starry fays. But here there is no light, save what from heaven is with the breezes blown, through verdurous glooms and winding mossy ways. I cannot see what flowers are at my feet, nor what soft incense hangs upon the boughs. But in embalmed darkness, guess each sweet wherewith the seasonable month endows, the grass, the thicket, and the fruit tree wild, white hawthorn, and the pastoral eglantine, fast fading violets covered up in leaves, and mid May's eldest child, the coming musk rose full of dewy wine, the murmurous haunt of flies on summer eves. Darkling, I listen, and for many a time I have been half in love with easeful death, called him soft names in many a mused rhyme to take into the air my quiet breath. Now more than ever seems it rich to die, to cease upon the midnight with no pain, while thou art pouring forth thy soul abroad in such an ecstasy. Still wouldst thou sing, and I have ears in vain, to thy high requiem become a sod. Thou wast not born for death, immortal bird. No hungry generations tread thee down. The voice I hear this passing night was heard in ancient days by emperor and clown. Perhaps the selfsame song that found a path through the sad heart of Ruth when, sick for home, she stood in tears amid the alien corn. The same that oft-times hath charmed magic casements opening on the foam of perilous seas in fairy lands forlorn. Forlorn. The very word is like a bell to toll me back from thee to my soul self. Adieu, the fancy cannot cheat so well as she is famed to do, deceiving elf. Adieu, adieu, thy plaintive anthem fades. Past the near meadows, over the still stream, up the hillside, and now 'tis buried deep in the next valley glades. Was it a vision or a waking dream? Fled is that music. Do I wake or sleep?
Bent double, like old beggars under sacks, knock-kneed, coughing like hags, we cursed through sludge, till on the haunting flares we turned our backs, and towards our distant rest began to trudge. Men marched asleep, many had lost their boots, but limped on bloodshot. All went lame, all blind, drunk with fatigue, deaf even to the hoots of tired, outstripped 5-9 shells that dropped behind. Gas! Gas! Quick, boys! An ecstasy of fumbling, fitting the clumsy helmets just in time, but someone still was yelling out and stumbling and floundering like a man in fire or lime. Dim through the misty panes and thick green light as under a green sea, I saw him drowning. In all my dreams, before my helpless sight, he plunges me, guttering, choking, drowning. If in some smothering dreams you too could pace behind the wagon that we flung him in, and watch the white eyes writhing in his face, his hanging face like a devil's, sick of sin. If you could hear at every jolt the blood come gargling from the froth-corrupted lungs, obscene as cancer, bitter as the cud of the vile, incurable sores on innocent tongues, my friends, you would not tell with such high zest to children ardent for some desperate glory the old lie, dulci et decorum est pro patria.
Red wheelbarrow. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens.
Wow, what a mixture we had there of those three poems. We began with Ode to a Nightingale, which is a classic Keats poem, mm-hmm. read by Robert Donat. Then we had Dulce Decorum Est, It's from an album called What Passing Bells. That's a Wilfred Owen World War I poem, a beautiful mm-hmm. performance of that poem. Do you know that album, What Passing Bells?
I don't know it well, but I know that it's an album that Penny Rimbaud produced that is entirely composed of Wilfred Owen war poems, and they're all set to music. And yeah, we could hear the kind of almost like atonal sound of the music really accompanying well the content of the poem. I'd like to listen to more of that.
Yeah, and then hot on the heels of that beautiful Wilfred yeah. Owen poem came, you know, screeching through the Red Wheelbarrow, which we've played on our show before. I think I played it as an example of one of the funniest readings of a poem, most amusing to me anyways. Yeah. In particular, as I said earlier, you know, previously, because it's a kind of imagistic poem, it doesn't really lend itself well to being read. It's so short, and also the first time I heard it, I was just taken aback by the nasal sound of William Carlos Williams's voice in reading that haiku. Mm-hmm. But so we had an ode, we had a World War I poem that was really quite graphic and brought mm-hmm. us into the experience of being in battle during World War I. The title of the poem, Dulce Decorum Est, is a phrase from the Roman poet Horace, which means it is sweet and fitting to die for one's country. And you get the sense that Horace is being used ironically mm-hmm. in this poem when that line finally does come in.
Yeah, thinking of thinking of form though, because thinking of the ode and then like the sort of, would you say like a Homeric epic is being sort of referred to there, or just like this, there's sort of like the epic poem of the war poem, but also using that in a more subversive way in what Wilfred Owen does, and then the haiku. So we're thinking of different forms of poetry. And it's interesting because the first poems we were listening to, we were really focusing on the rhythm of the line. And in this one, maybe thinking a bit more about the kind of what the form evokes, like what, you know, ode to a nightingale, what is an ode, what is evoked through that form, you know, the war poem and sort of the Homeric tradition, what is evoked through that. And then in the haiku, what are the possibilities within such a short space of a poem, how to create a very vivid imagery, how to create rhythm in such a short time. So it felt like, yeah, we were thinking about different forms of poetry and different traditions in that set.
Yeah, I often like to think of genres of poetry in terms of like the way designers think about the affordances of objects or even media.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and that different poetic forms lend themselves well to different kinds of expression, you know.
Right. Yeah.
I love odes. I mean, I teach 19th century literature and I've taught romantic poetry for many years, and the ode was a sort of very important form for the romantic poets, and Keats being one of them, who wrote many great odes. But I love the ode because there's a lot of room for movement between registers of feeling in an ode. And it's always sort of focused, though, in a mode of address to a particular
right.
thing,
yeah.
right? It's the odes are the poems where you find a lot of O, right? You know, just the letter O, and then which signifies, you know, sort of addressing someone, turning towards something
yeah.
and talking to it. And in this case, Ode to a Nightingale, you have the speaker hearing a nightingale mm-hmm. And in a way disoriented, trying to locate the source of ultimately what is his feeling that's evoked from the sound of the nightingale that he's hearing, but not being able to sort of locate exactly where that bird is. And so it's kind of an interesting ode in that sense that all odes sort of summon the presence of the thing that they're addressing. But mm-hmm. in Ode to a Nightingale, there's an equation of that experience of not being able to locate the sound exactly, precisely, and bring it to view with becoming increasingly drunk, you know, and disoriented. And so there's a movement into disorientation that I love in that particular poem.
Wow. I really enjoyed listening to that poem, as almost it felt like you were doing a Michel Chion, like thinking about the source of the sound and how in sort of causal listening, when you're listening for the source of the sound, I felt like you were like reading the poem through that. And that feels like a very contemporary kind of sound studies approach, approach to the poem, which I very much appreciate.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. I mean, I do think he goes far with thinking about the implications of hearing that sound. Mm-hmm. From stanza to stanza, he thinks about, oh, it's the same sound that would have been heard, you know, in biblical times, like right. that Ruth would have heard, et cetera. Yeah. Yeah. So there's a sense almost of through the genetic passing of that capacity to sing the way the nightingale can, that there's a coherency between human listening across time, but also a coherency of that sense of probably disorientation of trying to actually locate the source of it. So it's both disorienting, but at the same time, in some ways, linking us all, you know, living and dead in history through a kind of replication of the sounds that we all get to hear over time, as the creatures renew themselves, you know, through death and then birth. You know.
Yeah, it also makes me think of how we're listening to classic poems that have, you know, continued to make themselves heard over time, and thinking about the ways in which sometimes the, you know, poetry can be about like thinking about, you know, like how will these words, how will this thought be able to make itself heard over time and sort of become timeless by becoming the poem. So I like that the nightingale got us to think about that through sound.
Yeah, and I think maybe another factor in being a classic is that it lends itself to be heard and reheard, you know, read and reread
many times,
and thought about in different ways, you know, depending on where one is at in one's own life as well. And so, you know, a poem that is opaque enough, you know, to withstand recurrent scrutiny, you know,
the test of time, and to read it at many different points in one's life, and for it to still resonate and to continue to resonate in new ways. So next up is the poem Still I Rise that's read by Maya Angelou, and then we'll see what comes after that.
Out of the huts of history's shame, I rise. Up from a past rooted in pain, I rise. A black ocean leaping and wide, welling and swelling, I bear in the tide, leaving behind nights of terror and fear. I rise into a daybreak miraculously clear. I rise, bringing the gifts that my ancestors gave. I am the hope and the dream of the slave.
Mending wall. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen groundswell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun and makes gaps even two can pass abreast. The work of hunters is another thing. I have come after them and made repair where they have left not one stone on a stone, but they would have the rabbit out of hiding to please the yelping dogs. The gaps I mean, no one has seen them made or heard them made, but at spring mending time we find them there. I let my neighbor know beyond the hill, and on a day we meet to walk the line and set the wall between us once again. We keep the wall between us as we go, to each the boulders that have fallen to each, and some are loaves and some so nearly balls we have to use a spell to make them balance. Stay where you are until our backs are turned. We wear our fingers rough with handling them. Oh, just another kind of outdoor game, one on a side. It comes to little more. There where it is, we do not need the wall. He is all pine, and I am apple orchard. My apple trees will never get across and eat the cones under his pines, I tell him. He only says good fences make good neighbors. Spring is the mischief in me, and I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Why do they make good neighbors? Isn't it where there are cows? But here there are no cows. Before I build a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out, and to whom I was like to give offense. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. I could say elves to him, but it's not elves exactly, and I'd rather he said it for himself. I see him there, bringing a stone grasped firmly by the top in each hand, like an old stone savage, armed. He moves in darkness, as it seems to me, not of woods only, in the shade of trees. He will not go behind his father's saying, and he likes having thought of it so well, he says again, good fences make good neighbors.
I carry your heart with me. I carry it in my heart. I am never without it. Anywhere I go, you go, my dear. And whatever is done by only me is your doing, my darling. I fear no fate, for you are my fate, my sweet. I want no world, for beautiful you are my world, my true. And it's you are whatever a moon has always meant, and whatever a sun will always sing is you. Here is the deepest secret nobody knows. Here is the root of the root, and the bud of the bud, and the sky of the sky of a tree called life, which grows higher than soul can hope or mind can hide. And this is the wonder that's keeping the stars apart. I carry your heart.
You're listening to Sonic Lit. I do it at least once a show. Sonic Lit, a spoken web radio show. And we are listening to some classic poems this afternoon. We just heard Still I Rise, as read by Maya Angelou. Then we heard The Mending Wall by Robert Frost, as read by Robert Frost.
Yeah, we really got to hear his speaking poetry in that one. It sounded like he was just talking to someone. Quite an amazing performance of that poem, actually, because it's a very structured rhyming poem, and yet when you listen to it, it really just sounds like he's speaking in natural speech a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm. And then the last poem we heard was by E.E. Cummings, I carry your heart with me.
It's funny to hear the E. Cummings poem, because on the page, E. Cummings, who doesn't use capital letters or punctuation and uses all kinds of strange lineations, his poems look extremely sort of avant-garde, let's say, on the page. But when you hear Cummings read his poems, they sound really quite, sappy in a lot of ways, really quite traditional. So there's a strange discord there, I think, between him on the page and then what you hear when he's reading it.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed getting to hear that one. So, you're listening to Sonic Lit on CGLO 1690.
Dive into the ultimate comic haven at Crossover Comics. Unleash your inner geek with the best selection of graphic novels, manga, games like Pokemon and Magic, in-store events, merch, and more. Our knowledgeable and friendly staff have got your back with awesome recommendations for your next read. Score big with a free account. Enjoy comic subscriptions and membership discounts. Be in on the action at 3560 Notre Dame West in St. Henry, right near Metro Lionel Brew. Crossover Comics, sharing your passions since 2012.
You're listening to Sonic Lit, a spoken web radio show. We're live on CGLO 1690. And a reminder that this is the funding drive. It is time, always once a year for the annual funding drive at CGLO. Go to cglofundingdrive.com and find out all the ways to contribute and check out their fantastic merch. Jason, I didn't tell you, but I have bought a t-shirt.
Oh my God. You know what? I bought so much swag last year and I forgot to pick it up.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm going to have to just do it again. And this time, really make sure I get here in time to get my mug and my t-shirt and everything.
Yeah, no, I've got the zine from last year on my desk in my office. And I'm looking forward to putting on the t-shirt with my donation this year. So do check out CGLO's funding drive and donate if you can. Thanks.
Yeah. So we're gonna play our way out of this show with a couple of classic 19th century poems, Dover Beach, by Matthew Arnold.
Yeah.
I'll be teaching this next week, actually, in my Victorian literature class. And it's an incredibly sort of modern sounding poem, and also formally. It's not like a very well structured, it's a free verse poem, but it's written, you know, in the 19th century, late 19th century, but still mid to late 19th century. Ozymandias, we're going to hear Shelley's famous poem as read by Vincent Price. So that's going
to
be a treat.
Looking forward to that. Yeah.
And we won't get to it all, but we've played it before on our show, but we'll hear a little bit of Sylvia Plath's Daddy as we fade out into the news.
All right. Well, thanks for listening to these poems with us today.
I carry it Dover in Beach. My heart.
The sea is calm tonight. The tide is full, the moon lies fair upon the straits. On the French coast the light gleams and is gone. The cliffs of England stand glimmering and vast out in the tranquil bay. Come to the window, sweet is the night air. Only from the long line of spray where the sea meets the moon-blanched land, listen. You hear the grating roar of pebbles, which the waves draw back and fling at their return up the high strand, begin and cease, and then again begin with tremulous cadence slow, and bring the eternal note of sadness in. Sophocles, long ago, heard it on the Aegean, and it brought into his mind the turbid ebb and flow of human misery. We find also in the sound a thought, hearing it by this distant northern sea. The sea of faith was once, too, at the full, and round earth's shore lay like the folds of a bright girdle furled. But now I only hear its melancholy, long, withdrawing roar, retreating to the breath of the night wind down the vast edges drear and naked shingles of the world. Ah, love, let us be true to one another. For the world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. And we are here, as on a darkling plain swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night.
From an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read which yet survive.
Daddy, you do not do, you do not do any more black shoe in which I have lived.
This is Remy from Method.